Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, February 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Richard Bryan of Arthritis Care PC in Troy and Clifton Park, New York. He is here to answer your questions about a range of rheumatologic conditions. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the Saratoga Hospital Medical Group, introducing new and expanded clinical programs, including wound healing, audiology, and sports medicine. SaratogaHospital.org. Dr. Richard Bryan is with us. We always get a lot of calls on Medical Monday, so call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Rheumatology Today, your calls are coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Richard Bryan of Arthritis Care PC in Troy on Clifton Park, New York. Dr. Bryan earned his medical degree from the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. He completed his internship and internal medicine residency at Yale New Haven. He remained at Yale New Haven Hospital for his rheumatology fellowship training and is board certified in internal medicine and rheumatology. He treats a diverse array of rheumatologic conditions, ranging from non-inflammatory or mechanical disorders to systemic inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and connective tissue diseases such as lupus. If you have a question today, the number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Richard Bryan, welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ray.
Well, I have so many questions about this. First of all, for those who haven't had to deal with it yet, what exactly is arthritis?
So arthritis is essentially joint pain. And arthritis comes in many different flavors, but I try to think of it in two big categories, and that could be driven by inflammation or not. So it's a simple dichotomy, inflammatory reasons for joint pain versus non-inflammatory reasons. And the inflammatory reasons tend to be systemic. And when I say systemic, I mean they affect not just the joints, but everything from head to toe, meaning eyes, heart, lungs, liver, kidney, skin. And so inflammatory arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, is known to affect all organ systems. And it has a penchant for the lungs as well as the eyes. And it's important to recognize that. So that first category is the inflammatory arthritis. The second category refers to or attempts to describe the non-inflammatory reasons. And this includes the garden variety osteoarthritis, used synonymously with wear and tear arthritis.
All right, and that's
among
one,
others.
And that's the one that you said to me before the show. None of us are spared from that.
very few of us are, yeah. Because as we use our joints our entire lives, and the more active we are, of course, that process can be accelerated. But farther time, unfortunately, spares very few of us. This is just essentially wear and tear. Whereas a football player can have premature advanced presentation of wear and tear arthritis, where someone who's more sedentary won't, the ultimate endpoint is that pretty much most of us will end up with it.
How do you treat both varieties of arthritis?
And that's a very loaded and very a question that warrants a very extensive answer. Oh. Let me try and distill it as much as I can.
Okay.
And this is an exciting time for rheumatology. And when I say exciting, I mean we now have medications in our arsenal that are capable of putting patients in remission for conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, right? 20, 30 years ago, that was a word that we couldn't even use in the same sentence with rheumatoid arthritis. Now we have these biologic agents, and I'm sure many of us have seen these ads on the TV, Humira and Enbrel and all of these medications, Xeljanz, that are capable of putting someone, of wiping out the inflammation and quenching or quenching the activity of that inflammation and damage to the point where there is almost zero activity. So it's exciting because now we have medications we can use to have patients feeling better and getting back to their way, their quality of life and their routine activities.
Can I just stop you there for a minute? Now, we've seen the ads. You mentioned the ads on TV for the various, not cures, but certainly ways to deal with rheumatoid arthritis. Some of the side effects are terrifying.
Indeed, indeed. And those have to be listed. But it's always, the way I generally present that to my patients is that, yes, these are medications that are potentially quite dangerous.
Yeah.
And everything that we do is based on a risk-benefit assessment. So this is where the provider's acumen now comes into play. It's not for every patient. There are certain conditions or certain comorbidities, meaning additional conditions in which it makes it unwise to consider medications like these. But for the vast majority of us, these medications aren't as scary as they appear.
All right. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Bryan. It is Medical Monday, and we talk rheumatology and arthritis in specific topic here. But anything you really want to touch on as far as rheumatology is fair game. The number is 800-348-2551. You've heard the program, right?
I have.
All right, we're going to take some calls now.
And I'm a fan.
Are you ready?
I am indeed ready.
All right, let's do this then. Mickey in Albany. Mickey, you're on.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Bryan.
Hello, Mickey.
I've been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis for many years, was treated with methotrexate and with Xeljanz, and 2 years ago, after taking Xeljanz, I developed a severe herpes infection in my mouth. So, of course, I stopped the Xeljanz. Now, for the past 2 years, I've had no symptoms at all, and I've been very comfortable. No arthritis symptoms at all, and now they seem to be recurring in that I'm having this severe pain in my hands and wrist. Any suggestions?
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't. Could you repeat your name, please?
My name is Mickey.
Mickey. Mickey, thank you so much for the call. This is a very, very good question because it's a question that is posed quite often by my patients. And so you have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune inflammatory condition. So when I say autoimmune, I mean the body is generating antibodies that's attacking itself. Normally, these antibodies are directed to invaders, but that system goes awry and the body is now attacking itself. Xeljanz is one of the not so new treatment options anymore, but it's what we classify as a small molecule, which is similar potency and efficacy as the biologics, the proteins that I mentioned earlier, like Enbrel and Humira. And it's very effective at wiping out inflammation and therefore improving the symptoms. However, as was alluded to earlier, these medications can also lower the body's defenses. And it's interesting because the body's defense mechanism is also linked to the inflammatory process. So wiping out inflammation, unfortunately, can also lower the body's defenses, making one more a bit more susceptible to infections. And what's kind of not unique but interesting about the class of medications that Xeljanz belongs to, the JAK inhibitors is the term that's used, is that it can lower the body's defenses in a way that predisposes to activation of herpes zoster. And this can happen. You're a testament to the fact that it does, and it's quite unfortunate. And what was done, however, was correct in that the Xeljanz was stopped, and I'm inclined to think that the zoster was treated unsuccessfully. Now, you continue to do well for a while because I'm assuming that you initially had a good response to the Xeljanz. Well, with the cessation of the Xeljanz, what was believed to have been a good response to a genetic condition, i.e. the rheumatoid arthritis, now results in a reactivation or a presentation of these same symptoms because you were in remission, but you weren't cured. And unfortunately, what you're seeing now is the symptomatology raising its head again. Mm. So what that is telling us is that perhaps we're going to need to consider other treatment options. And there are many. As I said earlier, we now have a plethora of options with regards to getting your rheumatoid arthritis in very good control.
Mickey, thanks for the call. Now, is it common for someone like Mickey to stop taking the medication and then for 2 years, fine? And after a couple of years, start to get the symptoms again?
I wouldn't say common. 2 years is an extended period, but we do have a few people who continue to do well post cessation of the medication. Generally, I'm more inclined to see months, like 4 to 6 months, the person will continue to do well, but then the symptomatology again becomes aggressive.
Now, you mentioned that this is an autoimmune disorder. Do we know what causes it? You said genetics, but is there a specific reason that you can see for this to begin?
Yes, and the causes would appear to be multifactorial, and let me elaborate on that. There is a strong genetic component, and we know this. There are certain and HLA-DR4. There are certain allelic presentations.
What does that mean?
When I say allelic, alleles are associated with the genes.
Okay.
So there are certain genetic mutations, if you will, that will predispose to rheumatoid arthritis. And these involve HLA, DR4. The names are irrelevant, but
right.
There's a strong genetic component. But we also know that there appears to be an environmental component as well. And this is where it gets interesting, because we know that certain infections, gingival, right, gum infections,
right.
Seem to play a role. Not just that, smoking, tobacco use has been shown to predispose or actually trigger rheumatoid arthritis symptoms, in accordance with other things, of course. And so we know that someone who has that genetic predisposition and then they smoke as well, there is an increased likelihood of that rheumatoid arthritis becoming a bit more present and aggressive.
Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest. It's Medical Monday, Rheumatology Today. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Vox Pop Medical Monday. Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest, 800-348-2551. Before we get back to the calls, Dr. Bryan, you seem to have, and I say you, but I mean medical science, seems to have a handle on what triggers rheumatoid arthritis or some of the markers that are activated when it happens. How close are we then to a cure?
And again, a very good question. Let me just preface this by saying, yes, the more we know, the more we need to realize how much we don't know. So we have many of that. We have many answers, but there's still so much we don't know. So with regards to answering that question as to how close we are to a cure, that is anybody's guess. And
okay.
And I can't predict that one way or another.
Well, let's put it this way. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I am optimistic. With the strides that we've made over the last few years, last few decades, actually, to the point where now we can talk about putting someone in complete remission, that's remarkable in and of itself. So I have no reason but to be optimistic about us being one day being able to say we can provide a cure.
One quick email here, doctor, and then we'll get back to the phones. And I love Medical Monday because it's usually the emails that trip me up with things I can't say. But I'll try to read this for you. This is from Jesse. My daughter, age 6, had PFAPA, periodic fever, aphthous stomatitis, pharyngitis, and adenitis. It is recommended that she have her tonsils out, but we have been told it might not help. Do you know if tonsils out really helps? And that's from Jesse in Lenox.
Yes, another very good question. So FAPA is one of the periodic fever syndromes, and generally in younger folks, the younger ones among us. And yes, tonsillectomy can be known to be curative for FAPA.
Okay.
So yes, that's correct.
All right, back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jim and Matamoros. Jim.
Is the arthritis associated with pyroplasmosis regressive over time, or does it progressively get worse?
Hello, Jim, and thank you for the question. So your question is, did you say your joint pain is, if your anaplasmosis gets worse over time? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anaplasmosis, but BCIS.
Okay. Yes. Okay. I see. Okay. Yes, Jim. So anaplasmosis, it's the newer term for ehrlichiosis, and it's a tick-borne infection, just like Lyme. And it can, of course, cause a reactive arthritis, meaning arthritis in reaction to the initial insult, which is the infection. And with treatment of that infection, Jim, there should be resolution of those symptoms. What we do know is that in a small subset of patients, however, there can be lingering joint issues, joint complaints. Now, this does not mean that the infection is ongoing and active. This would more point towards a non-inflammatory chronic pain process. So treating or extending the treatment for this anaplasmosis perhaps isn't the way to go. Perhaps a better option would be to deal now with a non-inflammatory treatment option, meaning you don't want to prolong the antibiotics to the point where someone is on, let's say, doxycycline for, 6 months or a year.
Jim, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Dr. Richard Bryan of Arthritis Care PC in Troy on Clifton Park is our guest today. We go to Tammy in Saratoga. Tammy.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Tammy.
Hi, Dr. Bryan. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you.
I have a question. I actually was diagnosed just about 2 years ago in Boston, at Boston Mass General and also Brigham Women's Hospital concurrently, by two experts with what is called psoriatic arthritis, which is very similar to what you spoke about, RA. But much more difficult to diagnose because it doesn't show up on blood work. I was quite advanced when I was diagnosed, and I have been on multiple biologics in the last 2 years, which I've failed due to infections or not being able to tolerate them. So my question is, can you just speak to PSA, psoriatic arthritis, and how it's an inflammatory autoimmune disease also, like RA, but my understanding is harder to diagnose, harder to treat due to the comorbidities. And could you just speak to how you would go about diagnosing that and what you just know about that disease as it relates to RA and its ability to be in remission for someone who's very advanced?
Yes. Very good question, Tammy. And so psoriatic arthritis falls under that umbrella of inflammatory arthritides that I mentioned earlier. So the same way you have rheumatoid arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis and all these other conditions, psoriatic arthritis is one of them. And psoriatic arthritis is related in many, many ways to psoriasis. And we know that maybe one-third of patients with psoriasis can develop arthritis related to the psoriasis. Mm. This is also an autoimmune inflammatory process, meaning the body is attacking the joints. It's when there are defined antibodies, it's easy to make a diagnosis of an inflammatory arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis. But you're correct when you said psoriatic arthritis doesn't appear to have a strong association with any particular antibody. So that makes it a little more challenging. And this is where the clinical index of suspicion becomes vital. This is where getting a thorough history and physical becomes vital. Because all of these arthritides, inflammatory arthritides, yes, they're all inflammatory, but they have certain subtleties in their presentation that will lead one, meaning an astute provider, in a certain direction. Psoriatic arthritis prefers certain joints. It loves the spine and where the spine meets the hips, the sacroiliac joints. It loves the distal joints of the hands and the fingers, meaning the DIPs. And yeah, Exactly. And so there are certain areas that psoriatic arthritis loves. So if one takes a good history and a thorough physical exam, one should be able to figure out which direction we're going, despite the antibodies being negative in the blood work. Now, bear in mind that even though we try to think of psoriatic arthritis as what we term a serum negative inflammatory process, it is what we describe as quote-unquote promiscuous. And when I say promiscuous, I'm referring to the fact that many different antibodies can in fact be associated with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. We have some patients with psoriatic arthritis who can have rheumatoid factor, which is an antibody that's strongly associated with rheumatoid arthritis. That doesn't mean they have rheumatoid arthritis. That's the presence of the antibody that's associated with psoriatic arthritis. Psoriatic arthritis can also be associated with the antibody that we tend to think of with lupus, the ANA. So To simplify the presentation, we can say it's deemed a serum negative inflammatory arthritis. But in essence, it can be associated with many different antibodies.
All right, Tammy, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest on this Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Susan in Rensselaer. Susan.
Hi.
Hello, Susan.
I was diagnosed in the fall with arthritis of the feet. My feet had been very painful and tender, and I had quit walking on them and tried to rest and thought just rest would help. But the diagnosis by a podiatrist at the Whitney M. Young Junior Clinic was arthritis of the feet. Is there any lifestyle or any recommendation that the kind doctor can think of for what could ameliorate the situation?
Understood.
I really do like walking.
Indeed, and we'd like to encourage that in every way, Suzanne. Thank you for the call. Yes, Suzanne, so when you mentioned that you were diagnosed with arthritis of the feet and the fact that the pain tends to worsen with increased activity, I'm more inclined to think we're dealing with a non-inflammatory process, osteoarthritis, wear and tear arthritis, if you will. Mind you, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's going on, but it certainly would appear so. And the x-rays can be very informative. I'm inclined to think the x-rays would show evidence of joint space narrowing and spurs and so on.
But what sort of thing can you do if it's just wear and tear?
So that's a good question. So if it's wear and tear, what we know is conservative approaches are best initially. And when I say conservative approaches, I mean recruiting the help of many of our podiatry colleagues. And we can consider inserts. We can think of proper footwear. Physical therapy or physical therapy colleagues could also be very helpful here. And let's not belittle the importance of simple analgesics. And when I say simple analgesics, Suzanne, I'm referring to things like Tylenol, NSAIDs. When used, NSAIDs meaning a little Motrin or so on, when used in conjunction with the other modalities that I mentioned, can actually be quite helpful and allow you to maintain that quality of life of walking, which you love so much.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest. Having fun so far?
Oh, a blast.
All right, let's keep at it, and we go to Adam in Germantown. Adam.
Hello. I have a uveitis eye inflammation. I've been on Remicade for over 10 years, and I'm considering stopping it. I've been seen mostly by an eye doctor who specializes in uveitis, and my question is, also recently, separately, I had a cellulitis in the leg, and the ER doctor thought I might have had psoriasis when she saw some white skin around my knee. So I guess my question is two parts. One, when stopping Remicade after 10 years and switching to steroid eye injections, anything you think I should do to help that along? And two, to diagnose psoriasis, can a rheumatologist do that effectively, or should I instead see a dermatologist?
Yes. Very good questions, Adam, and thank you for them. So uveitis, doesn't oftentimes exist in isolation. It can actually be an indication of a more systemic, more untoward process going on. And uveitis can be associated with psoriatic arthritis. And on occasion, you can have uveitis being the initial manifestation of psoriatic arthritis. So it preceded the rash. So it's seen quite fairly often where initial uveitis is associated with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. So yes, this is seen and can be encountered. Your second question was what can be done, meaning can the rheumatologist make the diagnosis and enact an appropriate treatment plan? And yes, in fact, as a rheumatologist, my prime directive is to view everything from a more comprehensive approach. These conditions affect not just the eyes. They affect the lungs, the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the joints. And as a rheumatologist, we think in those terms, meaning the skin being unified with the eyes, being unified with the joints, can ultimately lead us to establishing a good treatment regimen, which by all accounts would appear to be a biologic, which you're already on, it would appear, the Remicade, which appears to be doing well, is my understanding. Is that correct?
We lost Adam, but okay. Thank you for the call. Mm-hmm. Adam in Germantown. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest. Let's talk for a minute about lupus and a couple of questions. One, if you could just educate me on the similarities between the causation of rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, and any sort of advancements we've made in treating lupus in the last 20 years.
Yes, so under that inflammatory arthritis category, lupus is one of them as well, but it's slightly different. And that's why we would refer to lupus as a connective tissue disease process and not refer to rheumatoid arthritis as such. But this is an autoimmune condition, and it's an abnormal interaction between cells of the immune system, B and T cells, that leads to aberrant antibody production. It causes joint pain, of course, but also has a penchant for affecting many different organ systems. It loves the kidneys, right? So lupus nephritis is a huge concern as well. Rheumatoid arthritis doesn't do this. Rheumatoid arthritis tends to spare the kidneys. Rheumatoid arthritis loves the lungs. Lupus tends to spare the lungs. So there are certain nuances in their presentation that leads us in a certain direction.
But are there similar genetic markers in the early going?
Yes, and there are. But the antibodies that tend to be associated with lupus are very different. We're talking primarily about the ANA, and I alluded to that earlier. So the ANA is strongly associated with lupus. But very nonspecific, I should add.
Have we made strides in the treatment of lupus?
Lupus has been very hardy over the years. We now have biologic agents similar to what we have for rheumatoid arthritis, biologic agents that are actually quite effective at putting someone in good control. But it's been a bit more challenging getting many of our lupus patients, especially severe lupus patients in a remittive state. But that being said, we have many options as well. There's Benlysta, which is an infusion, and it can be injected as well. That is very good for lupus. We also have other medications like Rituxan, which doesn't have that absolute indication, but it's also very effective with regards to treating hard refractory lupus, especially with lupus nephritis.
Why has it been more difficult to achieve better success with remission with lupus?
That's a good question. And I think a lot stems from the fact that the presentation is so protean. The presentation is so varied. And addressing all of these different presentations is just proven to be much more challenging.
Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest, rheumatology today on Vox Pop Medical Monday. The number is 1-800-348-2551. Let's grab another call or two before the next break. We'll go to Rich in Whitesboro. Rich.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I had a question about inflammatory arthritis. The doctor mentioned that it can attack the lungs. And there's so many symptoms people get with lungs, and I was just wondering how you can tell the difference, if you should be alerted to it or checking it out. If, say, you get a chronic cough, and would this condition cause like an ebb and flow of a cough?
Yes. And Richard, certainly can. And the first step is to get a chest X-ray, right? But this is where also history and physical becomes very important, because if someone has a smoking history, right, that could also cause lung findings that can look similar to the findings from rheumatoid arthritis. So it's very important to get a good history and physical, get a good exam, and start with a chest X-ray. And then if needs be, I would go on to a CAT scan, because you can see certain findings in the lungs, pulmonary fibrosis and so on, honeycombing and traction bronchiectasis. There are certain specific terms that one can see that could be indicative of pulmonary fibrosis from another cause or another source versus pulmonary fibrosis or lung changes secondary to rheumatoid arthritis. But nothing trumps a biopsy. And that's where our pulmonary colleagues come in, because our pulmonary colleagues can now tell us definitively if this is due to an idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis process versus rheumatoid arthritis. Mm.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Medical Monday, Rheumatology Today with Dr. Richard Bryan. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Medical Monday. Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest today, and Dr. Bryan with Arthritis Care PC in Troy and Clifton Park, New York. The number to call is 800-348-2551 as this program hits the home stretch. A few emails here, Doctor, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Patricia. I have osteoarthritis in both hands. My pink fingers, last joints are deformed. Pinky, I believe. Last joints are deformed, slightly crooked. I'm 68. Is it possible to prevent further deformity when wearing finger splints at night work?
Yes, Patty. Yes, finger splints could be helpful. And a hand physical therapist could also play a very important role with regards to halting the worsening deformities. Mm-hmm. So, yes, finger splints would be helpful.
All right, this one is from Bernadette. My daughter is a 36-year-old white female and a mother of three. She developed tinnitus in October 2019. Then shortly after that, she has been losing the hair on her head, face, legs, and eyebrows. Blood work unremarkable, except for slight elevation of cholesterol. She is scheduled for an MRI with a contrast and vitamin panel. She is otherwise healthy. Any thoughts? We're very concerned. And that's from Bonnie in Albany.
Yes. Yes, that could be quite challenging. It sounds like we're dealing with an alopecia issue. It certainly would appear that this is an autoimmune process, and I think seeking the expertise of an immunologist wouldn't be a bad idea, a dermatologist as well.
This one is from Lori in Ulster Park. Lori writes, I'd like to ask the doctor about the current classification of fibromyalgia. For decades, doctors have been sending us to rheumatologists, but some research suggests it's not an inflammatory condition. Any thoughts on that? And that's from Lori in Ulster Park.
Yes, Lori. And fibromyalgia falls under that non-inflammatory category that I mentioned. And it's generally deemed or classified as non-inflammatory. Well, fibromyalgia used to be thought of as a catch-all phrase. We now know that that's not the case, right? There are certain defined presentations that would lead one towards fibromyalgia. And I generally describe it to my patients as an umbrella term. And under that umbrella, one can have a series of complaints like disrupted sleep, chronic fatigue, headaches, anxiety, depression, restless legs, TMJ. And of course, one moves in the direction of fibromyalgia when one has ruled out other processes like autoimmune inflammatory processes, since many of those conditions can also mimic fibromyalgia. And to make the assumption that it's fibromyalgia and miss something like that could be could be detrimental. So yes, fibromyalgia is considered to be non-inflammatory. We now know so much more about it. We know that the neurotransmitter norepinephrine plays a very important role, and increasing the norepinephrine levels in the cerebrospinal fluid can treat that.
And
that's
where. How do you do that?
There are certain medications that we refer to as SNRIs, serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, Cymbalta being the main one, that have been shown to be quite effective. So we have medications that can increase these levels.
All right. This last email is from Teresa, and then we'll jump back on the phones. Teresa in Richmondville writes, "My husband has several cysts in one ankle and has issues with it for several years. For the past couple of years, the ankle pain is usually accompanied by a significant inflammatory response that seems to migrate around from ankle to foot to knee. It usually occurs within the affected leg, but sometimes the other as well. His orthopedist doesn't think his bone issue is the cause of this response. He has high tick exposure and family history of rheumatoid arthritis, but has tested negative for both. Any ideas?"
Yes, that presentation would lend, and the fact that it's involving multiple joints, would lend to suspicion for an inflammatory rheumatologic process. Mm-hmm. And evaluation by a rheumatologist would be very important in a situation like this.
Now, is there a subjective element to your testing, or is there a hard and fast objective test that says, oh yeah, you got this?
Yeah, so, and again, this, which is why it's so important to emphasize a good history and physical, because so much can be unearthed with that. Maybe upon further questioning, we'll discover that he's had a dry patch of skin behind the left ear for years. He's never really thought much of it, but it's always been there and it's been annoying. And that could be discovered to be psoriasis, which could unify some of the complaints that are being described now, among many others.
Right.
Right. So it's really important for him to get a thorough rheumatologic assessment.
And there's a fair amount of detective work in your line of work.
Sleuthing, and that's what, thankfully, draws many a rheumatologist to the profession. We love to investigate, and we love the legwork and the thought process involved in arriving at a diagnosis.
Dr. Richard Bryan is our guest of Arthritis Care PC in Troy on Clifton Park. The number is 800-348-2551. We go to Mary in Delmar. Mary.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very well, Mary.
I am a licensed massage therapist, and I see a lot of clients with these sort of disorders that you've been speaking to this afternoon. I recently read a study that came up and discussed a deficiency of, say, zinc or magnesium and those sort of things, perhaps from deficiencies in the diet. And the study spoke to that perhaps maybe a treatment of those as first line. I respect modern medicine, but I'm wondering what your opinion on a deficiency such as zinc with autoimmune disorders and also diseases that affect fibrous tissue in the body.
That's a good question. I'm not sure I'm qualified to even attempt to answer a question like that. I'm not knowledgeable in complementary and alternative medicines. And I do know that zinc plays a very important role in many things. But with regards to attributing some of these deficiencies to these complaints would be outside of my comfort zone.
Mm. Congratulations, Mary. You stumped the band.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks
Take care,
a lot
Mary.
For the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And now to Mark in Salem. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Ray. I saw a very wonderful doctor, James Strasberg, who's now retired as a rheumatologist, for fibromyalgia, and we agreed at the end of that it was because of abusing my body, being a builder. But I found that when I met a woman in Palm Springs, California, who had rheumatoid arthritis, it was in a wheelchair, and she had moved down there. She was in her 80s when I met her. She had moved from a wheelchair to a walker to not using anything at all. and it was because of the hot, dry climate and lack of change of barometric pressure. And I wonder if the doctor could speak to that.
Yes, yes, a very good question indeed. And we do know that the warmth and humidity can, in fact, affect many of the different arthritides, inflammatory and non-inflammatory, and barometric pressure as well plays a very important role. I do have many patients who would state that when they head over to Arizona or Florida, the pain eases. And you're correct. A lot of this has to do with the barometric pressure. This is very characteristic of osteoarthritis primarily, but that is possible, yes.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Of course, that's standard folk wisdom. You know, an older person, it's happened to me after I busted up an elbow or whatever. Oh, I know it's going to rain.
Yes.
It hurts today. And,
yes.
And so what does this tell you about future treatment options?
Well, there is truth to that, indeed. Again, it's just another facet of something that another facet of information that we've gotten, so we can work towards finding out more about this.
Do you ever just tell a patient, hey, head to Palm Springs?
In as much as I'd love to do that, for many of my patients, that's not possible.
All right, fair enough. Back to the phones. Diane in Massachusetts. Diane, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Good afternoon, Diane.
About a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed in one finger with osteoarthritis. And the other finger, on my other hand, I was diagnosed with psoriatic. In the same time that the psoriatic arthritis appeared, it was discovered that I had lung nodules. So I had heard that it's only in men that get the lung nodules from psoriatic arthritis. I wanted to know if that's a correlation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so psoriatic arthritis, again, is an inflammatory arthritis, meaning it's not just the joints and the skin. It's everything from head to toe. So, yes, it certainly can result in findings in the lungs. It's not one of the usual culprits, however, but it certainly can happen. So, yes, that is possible. It would be very important, however, to have one of our pulmonary colleagues have a closer look at that, because they might want to even consider finding out a bit more about these nodules, right? Is a biopsy warranted? Maybe they want to look at it a bit more closely. But to answer that question, it's not uncommon for an inflammatory condition, inflammatory arthritis, to result in lung findings.
Okay. It seems coincidental that at just about the same time I developed the lung nodules. But I do get a CT every 6 months.
Wonderful. So
I had lung cancer, just two small nodules, very isolated and all that, but they're watching it. So I would prefer to get a biopsy if I could.
Yes, our lung colleagues are very adept at this, and if they thought it was absolutely necessary for you to have a biopsy, they would have been insistent. So it's comforting.
Sure.
It's comforting that they've decided to just watch it. But to answer the question, yes, psoriatic arthritis certainly can affect any organ system. Lungs are not often seen, but it can happen.
All right, Diane, thank you very much for the call. Our number here, 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday, Rheumatology Today with Dr. Richard Bryan of Arthritis Care PC in Troy and Clifton Park, New York, and Kathy in Florence, Mass. Kathy.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a question about IJA. And
what's IJA?
Why is that so difficult? Idiopathic juvenile arthritis in a 12-year-old.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually it's rheumatoid arthritis, but they've given it another name. I think so us parents and grandparents aren't so frightened. It's in a 12-year-old who's been an athlete. We had a terrible time getting it diagnosed because it started in his hip joints, and so they missed it. Until we ended up going to being in a children's hospital and being in Boston Children's. Can you address that at all, please? Because I feel so... And by the way, he's on Humira and methotrexate.
Wonderful, and I'm hoping he's
so
doing
well. They weren't able to get him in remission with Humira, so they've added the methotrexate in the last couple of weeks. And as an old medical administrator, it frightens me. I hear your opinion on
yes, and well, actually, methotrexate has been shown to be very well tolerated in children. So it heals, and they can use and tolerate much higher doses than adults. So it's an old chemo medication, but it works wonderfully. Just to get to your question, though, so. JIA, juvenile idiopathic arthritis, it took over for the old term, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And the idiopathic comes from the fact that JIA in kids as young as 2 years old, JIA can morph into many of the different inflammatory arthritides. So one can, a child diagnosed with JIA in a few years can turn out to have rheumatoid arthritis, or can turn out to have psoriatic arthritis, or can turn out to even have lupus. So that is what led them to reclassify and change the term from confining that person to juvenile rheumatoid arthritis to juvenile idiopathic arthritis, because it could be psoriatic arthritis 10 years from now. And that's what makes it so difficult from a diagnostic perspective. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Now, those are words. How does it affect the treatment?
Well, you treat all of these conditions very differently. The same way I mentioned that lupus, the treatment options for lupus very different from the treatment options for rheumatoid arthritis. They're all anti-inflammatories. They all work to wipe out inflammation, but they do it via different mechanisms.
But in other words, in the child with idiopathic form of this,
yes,
it has yet to branch into a specific subset.
Yes.
What does this tell you about the cause of the overall illnesses?
Yes. So it tells us that there appears to be a common root.
Right.
And if we can figure out, and there is ongoing investigation and studies to look at this a bit more closely, maybe we can intervene much earlier. As it stands right now, JIA is treated with the treatment options that she mentioned earlier, meaning the Humira and methotrexate and Remicade and so on. But later on, 10 years down the line, we could see a predominance of lupus, or a manifestation of lupus, that would prompt us to change what we do.
Our guest today is Dr. Richard Bryan, and back to the phones we go. Anna in Woodstock, you're on. Hello? Oh, you're listening on the radio, Anna. And that's it for you. I'm so sorry. We don't have time to mess around here. Linda in Albany. Linda, you're up.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hello, Linda.
Hi. Nice to meet you on the phone. Thank you so much for being here today. My daughter is 50 years old. She lives in Plattsburgh, New York. And at the age of 47, she was diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis. She had been to two rheumatologists in Plattsburgh and one in Brattleboro, Vermont. Because she worked as a graphic artist in a very small company, she had terrible insurance and could not afford the medication that they suggested she take. So she did some research, and she went on an anti-inflammatory diet, which is very, very restrictive, but she has been feeling so much better on it. And I'm wondering why rheumatologists are not suggesting this more often.
Yes. And it's not that we're not suggesting it. It's very important that we recognize that if the intention is to put someone in remission, the likelihood of achieving it with dietary discretion might not be possible. That being said, I would never minimize the importance of diet. And in fact, I emphasize this a lot with my patients. The recommendations, in accordance with the American College of Rheumatology dictates right now, is a cardiac healthy diet, a heart healthy diet, which is high protein, low fat, low carb, right? So that is the recommendation. But there are so many others out there, like we know about the nightshade diet, we know about the paleo. These are all deemed to be anti-inflammatory diets. The trick is, or the concern is, if when someone goes into this or adopts one of these diets, hoping that it will be remittive or curative, that could be a problem.
All right, and I guess that's where we'll have to leave it here. Well, Dr. Richard Bryan, well done on your first attempt here on Medical Monday.
Indeed, Jay. This has been fun, and thank you so much for having me.
Support comes from Gomez Neurology Albany, a neurology clinic and infusion center providing care for neuromuscular disorders and headaches, multiple sclerosis, and chronic pain. Patients see a physician at every visit, GomezNeurology.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Richard Bryan of Arthritis Care PC in Troy and Clifton Park for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Many apologies to all those on the line, including Anna in Woodstock, who tried again to get in. We just ran out of time. We'll get Dr. Bryan back, and we will answer your questions. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who came in thinking it was a fun drive, thinking he could relax and have a sandwich. He had to engineer the program. Well done, sir. Thanks to Kayleen White, who has been working on the fun drive and is now just done answering the phones on this program. Thanks to Jim Lavoulis, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, meteorologist Jason Goff is back to answer your weather questions. So if you got a question about occluded fronts or maybe a cold snap, anything, you know, friendly cumulus clouds, whatever, get them ready. We'll see you tomorrow at 2. Stand by for the Media Project.